Well, our gospel lesson for this week, every time this lesson comes up, I suppose every 3 years, right? I look at it, you know, weeks ahead if I'm choosing the hymns or if I'm just looking ahead to see what sermons might be like. And I always see this one about, you know, the coin and whose head is on it and, you know, giving to God, which is God's. And I always get excited because it talks about money. And I think, oh, good, I'm going to get to preach about stewardship. And I get excited about that because I love preaching about money and stewardship. And then the week comes when this lesson actually comes and I bother to read it like seriously and I study it and I'm, oh yeah, this isn't actually about money. This is not a stewardship sermon week. And I get bummed because now I got to talk about politics or whatever again, because that's what this one is really about. So if you've been with us in recent weeks, you may remember the scene is that Jesus is in the temple in Jerusalem in the last week of his life. He's already done the triumphal entry that is Palm Sunday. He's already flipped over the tables of the money changers. We don't get that one recently, unfortunately. He's just told three parables with the purpose of telling off the religious authorities there, the chief priests and the elders and the Pharisees so far. Today you get the Pharisees and the Herodians. And next, the story after this is the Sadducees, although we won't hear that story next week. But anyway, so he's going through this series of arguments with the religious authorities. And they challenge his authority, and he challenges them back. And it's kind of this series of arguments leading up to the arrest and the death of Jesus. So Jesus knows what's coming. He's agitated. He's on edge. He's not putting up with anybody's nonsense these days. And so we get this story today, where instead of telling a parable, he just has to answer a one-question pop quiz, I guess, from the disciples of the Pharisees and the Herodians. Now, this combination of people coming to Jesus today is a strange one. The Herodians are not attested outside of the New Testament. This isn't like a group of people that other people knew about. But they're called the Herodians, so we can reasonably assume that they are people who supported Herod and the Herod government that was existing there in Jerusalem. Now, that government worked closely with the Roman government. They had, you know, they were there, they were serving there on behalf of Rome, and Herod and his household were known to be Hellenistic, which means they liked Greek culture and Roman culture, and so they were kind of bringing in these other cultural elements and kind of expanding Israel's tastes to the rest of the world. Some people didn't like this, and some of the people who really didn't like this were the Pharisees. These are two groups who were opposed to each other. They had different views of the cultural assimilation that was happening and the cultural exchange that was happening. The Pharisees probably considered somebody like the Herodians to be traitors to their faith and traitors to their people. And so it's odd that these two groups would come together. These are different factions with very different views, presumably. You can think of them as different political parties, really. They have very different views of what should be happening and why things are happening. And the reason that these two people, these two groups of people would come together is because they had a mutual interest in stopping Jesus. Now, in order to understand more about this, the Pharisees makes a little sense. The Herodians one is a little dicier, but it helps to remember back to John the Baptist, whose ministry and death really, really looms over this whole section of Jesus' teaching in the temple. You know, earlier there had been the question Jesus had asked the chief priests whether John the Baptist was from God or not. That was the first argument that he had with them. And that really plays here as well. Remember, John the Baptist was arrested by Herod and eventually beheaded by Herod because he was denouncing Herod's family and Herod's illicit marriage practices and all these other things. Herod, he's a sinner, and John the Baptist was yelling about it a lot. The Pharisees probably liked that, because they didn't like Herod. They didn't like the stuff he did. They probably were on John's side for that. But the Pharisees also didn't like John the Baptist because he also criticized them and the religious power structure. You know, he was drawing people out to the river in the middle of nowhere when the Pharisees and the other religious authorities would rather draw them into the synagogues, draw them into the temple, of course, in Jerusalem. And so none of these people liked John the Baptist either, but at least their critiques then were sort of cross against each other. In this case, when they come together, the Pharisees and the Herodians, to question Jesus, there's a similar dynamic at play, which is that when they ask this question, is it lawful to give, to pay the tax to the emperor? They're trying to trick Jesus because each of these two sides has a different answer to that question. And whichever one he chooses, whichever one Jesus chooses, one of these sides is going to be mad. And they have a police force available to arrest Jesus, if it comes to that. So the Herodians, obviously, they have whoever arrested John the Baptist the first time could come and get Jesus, whether he's in the temple or as soon as he leaves. They're going to have the authority to do that. So if Jesus says, don't pay taxes, well, that's blasphemy against the emperor. That's clearly, you know, sedition or whatever it would be called. That's grounds for being arrested if he's teaching people not to pay their taxes to the emperor. And the Herodians would rat him out immediately, and he would be arrested by Herod, and Herod would take care of the Pharisees' problem, which is that Jesus is showing them up. On the other side, of course, if Jesus does say to choose to pay the taxes, then the Pharisees can be all mad. Well, the emperor is the bad guy. How dare you? You're supposed to be this faithful, following God guy, and yet you're gonna support the emperor? What's wrong with you? And that could turn the crowds against Jesus, and the Pharisees could once again become the good people who follow the law and who are faithful in all their practices. That's their hope. So whichever answer Jesus gives, either direction, he is likely to be in trouble with one group or the other, with the crowd, with the Pharisees, with the Herodians, with the, you know, one government or the other, with the chief priests. There's lots of people out to get Jesus. And they think that if they think this is a good question to trap him, because one side or the other is going to be able to nail him after this. Jesus, of course, defeats their question by refusing to choose a side. He refuses to be a pawn in their politics. He avoids the trap. You know, whose head is on the coin? Show me the coin. Whose head is on the coin? It's Caesar's. Well, then give to Caesar what's Caesar's, but give to God what is God's. And it says they were amazed. Most people interpret that to be they were speechless. They didn't know what to say anymore, and so they left. They just walked away. Now, this question brought up by today's lesson about the relationship between following God and following earthly government is a complicated one. It's a tricky one. It's one that people have always struggled with, followers of Jesus have always struggled with. The Lutheran tradition has a complicated relationship with this question, of course. You know, the original German Lutheran Reformation and the subsequent Lutheran Reformations in other places would not have been successful without the support of local governments. The reason Martin Luther got away with this stuff is because Frederick the Elector of Saxony heard what he was saying and said, yeah, I don't like the Roman Empire taking my money and trying to be over me. And I don't like how the Church of Rome, you know, works with that and keeps my power down. Frederick figured out, like, I could basically make more money and have more power if this stuff wasn't happening. And so he sided with Luther. And so the local sort of state and city municipal governments in Germany started siding with Luther and taking his side because it was good for them, because it made them money, because it gave them power. You know, when the situation continued, when the Lutheran Reformations advanced to other countries, the governments, like in say in Sweden, they were like, wait a minute, you're telling me if I believe what this guy Luther says, then we, the state government, can just take all the church's property and money? And then it's ours now? And they're like, yeah, pretty much, that's how it works. And they said, okay, let's do that. And so they did, because it got him a bunch of money and land. I mean, that was a big part of why he was supported. That's why when there was a war to stop this, the 30 Years' War, you know, 100 years later, that's why these countries sent their armies to fight against the Roman armies, because it was lucrative to have this Lutheran Reformation for them. And Martin Luther knew, he knew very well that his success depended on the patronage of these wealthy and powerful people. And so, as part of the response to all of that, Martin Luther developed this theory, and the Lutheran tradition developed this theory of the two kingdoms, which is the kingdom of God, essentially, and the kingdom of the earthly realm. And the bottom line on the two kingdoms, this is not the Lutheran theology that I'm most either familiar or comfortable with, to be honest. But the bottom line is saying, look, basically God has ordained that there will be earthly rulers who help us figure out how to manage things on earth. The church is not the government of the earth, and it shouldn't be. It's not the point. The church shouldn't have to figure out how to make the roads or keep the people safe or whatever. That's not what the church is for. The church shouldn't have armies. That's not what the church should be for, right? And so, in a sense, God has blessed and ordained these earthly governments to do their thing so that the church can do its thing. And this two kingdoms theory, it helps in Lutheran history because it creates space for respecting the government, for creating order. And within the order of the government, then the church can function and flourish and the people can function and flourish. And you can make schools and the community chest and all these other things that the Lutherans kind of invented in terms of social services. In their area, at least, they invented them so that the people could be healthy and happy. And it wasn't all the church's responsibility. The Lutherans did not believe in theocracy by any means. And yet, the churches in Germany and Sweden and those places became state churches. They were sanctioned by the state, related but separate. And so that's how that worked. Now, this whole two kingdoms thing worked out pretty well. It was beneficial when German Lutherans in this country had to scramble to start speaking English and prove their Americanness during World War I and World War II. Because they had this theology built in, this two kingdoms thing that said, oh, we respect the government. We think that God has put the government here for our protection and for our safety, for the good order of the world, so that the church can be the church and doesn't have to do everything. So it was easy for Lutherans to tell these Germans, hey, it's okay, you can start speaking English, you can support the government, you can be a good American and a good Christian. And that was helpful for some of these German-speaking people in World War I, when clearly it wasn't cool to be German in this country in World War I. Trust the government was really built into this part of Lutheran theology. Now, the most obvious flaw, or at least flawed example of the flaw, if you will, in this two kingdoms theory was happening just about the same time over in Germany when the Nazis took over. And the state church, the Lutheran church in Germany, mostly looked around and said, yeah, this is good. God put Adolf Hitler here. This is right. Let's do this. And went with it. And that was horrible. And the church basically acquiesced to the Holocaust and looked the other way and pretended something else was happening. And, you know, I've talked about this before, but like the presiding bishop, the bishop of the whole country, like rewrote the Sermon on the Mount in the Nazi version because he wanted to be cool to the Nazis. I mean, it was awful. That's a thing. That's a way in which this Lutheran respect for government can curdle, can go awry, can become a tool of evil. And so these, you know, theology is nice and whatever, but how we actually apply it in the world depends on a whole lot more than just saying, well, Luther said this or whatever nonsense it would be. So anyway, we talked about all this at our weekly Bible study on Wednesday, and by this point, I was thoroughly into a series of rants that I'm tamping down now and not giving you all those rants, because we don't need to sit here for an hour and listen to that. If you want to hear me rant about stuff, come to Bible study on Wednesday. You'll get even more than in these sermons, believe it or not. But for now, for today, let's move in this direction, which is to say last week's psalm was Psalm 23. Very famous and popular psalm, the most famous and popular psalm of our lifetimes, as far as I can tell, right? It's a great one. Everybody loves it. It's a good psalm. And in Bible study for that week, so a week and a half ago, somebody asked the question, is this the psalm that comes up the most in the lectionary? It comes up 6 times through the lectionary cycle on Sundays and, you know, Christmas, Easter type holidays. And I looked, I said, well, I don't know. And then this week, we get Psalm 96. And lo and behold, this psalm comes up more in the lectionary than does Psalm 23. Who knew? This is not just trivia for fun fact trivia. This is because Psalm 96 is the psalm for Christmas morning. On Christmas, there's 3 different lectionary things, and it's Psalm 96 on Christmas morning. We don't usually have church on Christmas morning, and I'm grateful for that. But if we did, we would hear this psalm every single year. Now, the way the lectionary works, and the way we read the Bible as Lutherans, and the way that I really like to teach people to read the Bible, is when you look at the Bible, if you don't just read it from cover to cover or whatever, start at the most important days in the lectionary, because those are the days when the people who put this stuff together said, hey, this is the important stuff. On the biggest days, we want to tell the most important stories. And the psalm for Christmas morning is pretty important. And it comes up 7 times throughout the whole lectionary year, or 3-year cycle. So you know that this psalm is really important. This psalm tells part of the central story of the gospel, of the good news of Jesus Christ. And if anything, when we look at the lessons for today, we should be reading this gospel lesson about the coin and the Caesar and whatever. We should be reading that through what we learn from Psalm 96. So let's think just a little bit, and hear just a little bit of Psalm 96. It's so good, cover to cover, but just this part. Declare God's glory among the nations and God's wonders among all peoples. For great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, more to be feared than all gods. As for all the gods of the nations, they are but idols. But you, O Lord, have made the heavens. It goes on. We can just read the whole thing. It's so good. This psalm is about the wonder and majesty and power of God, that God is more important than every nation, that God can be declared among all nations, and that the gods of the nations, the things that individual nations worship, are idols, are things that get in the way of God. When Jesus answered the question of the Pharisees and the Herodians, he answered it in such a way that they couldn't accuse him either direction. But Jesus knew this psalm. He knew the psalms like it. He knew, there's a whole section of these praise psalms doing these things. He knew that giving to God what belongs to God is so much more important and so much more than giving to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, giving the emperor in our translation today. Jesus knew that when we focus on that which belongs to the emperor, at some point that slides into idolatry. We're worshiping the wrong thing. If we worship money with the emperor's face on it, we worship the wrong thing. In our society today, it's pretty easy to understand our society as worshiping money, as worshiping power, earthly power, political power, as worshiping, even like white supremacy, basically, the way that it functions in our, I shouldn't go too far into that. I said I wouldn't rant too much today, so I'll try to take it back. The point is, this psalm makes clear that when they asked that question of Jesus, there was a right answer. Jesus knew the answer. He wasn't going to tell them. He wasn't going to be a pawn in their political game. He wasn't going to have the Pharisees say, see, we're the good guys, ha ha, Herodians, and start that fight and have the Herodians get mad and arrest Jesus. Jesus wasn't going to do that. But he knew that ultimately our lives belong to God. Jesus knew that to give God what is God's is more than any political argument. It's more than whatever they were trying to do to him that day. And I guess, we have getting this gospel lesson understood through Psalm 96, of course, in a presidential election year, and especially as contentious a year as this, I feel like I should just say something briefly about, I've been talking about this every week, but I should say something briefly about this election. And the obvious thing to say is this: vote your values, right? Vote for the things that your faith teaches you are right. Vote for love of neighbor. Vote for care for the widow and the orphan and the outcast and the sick. Vote for the inclusion of the resident alien and the foreigner and those things. There are so many values. Vote for love. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. There are some basic Christian values that can shape the way that we vote. And the thing is, even those basic Christian values are going to make people vote for different parties. And so as much as that might get on your nerves, that's how it is. Live with it. That's a whole lot better than the alternative. People say, we should keep religion out of politics, which is to say religion shouldn't matter in people's lives. I mean, politics is how we order our society. It's how we together communally make sense of things and create order. It's a real pain in the butt. Nobody likes politics. Even politicians mostly don't like it. But it's the structure that we have. It's the only possible way, because we have to order our society in some way. And our faith can help us to order it in a way that is led by the mercy and compassion and forgiveness of Jesus. That's the idea. That's what we're trying to do here. So do that. Most of the people on this call have already voted. I know that, which is fantastic. I love it. But I have to say those things for today. So anyway, give to God that which is God's, which is to say your whole self, your time, your allegiance, your love. Give to God that which is God's. Don't deny Caesar what is Caesar's. Do the government thing. Be a good citizen. That's important too. But recognize where that falls in relationship to your relationship to God. And listen to other people so that you don't get the two confused. Listen to people who are different than you so you don't get those things confused. Because that's the way we get confused. We just get in our own heads. We only talk to people like us who have our same interests, our same values, and we get skewed in one direction. If we start listening to other people who think things differently, who have different experiences, who come from different places, different color of skin, different socioeconomic backgrounds, we can see a broader picture of what God has in mind for our society. And we can recognize how our values in following Jesus can benefit everyone, all nations, not just ourselves. Amen.